Get this thing started this morning. Excited as we keep on with our series here, Welcome Home, as we begin our, as we continue our second week in this series, this idea of a church family on mission. This is taking a break from the book of Matthew and doing this series a little bit more topical than what we're used to, but just taking a few weeks to look at this. And we're covering a lot of ground here. We started last week and we're going to be in this for a few more weeks, but it's something that I think that we need in this stage of our church, where we are in the life of our church. We're in the process of making a lot of changes. We're trying to prepare ourselves for autonomy, what we hope to be autonomy in the coming year. And there's a lot that's tied to that. There's all kinds of things in that, from church health that would cover a lot of areas, from finances to unity to structure to discipleship, and so many different things that we are working on corporately together behind the scenes and that you see here as well. And so as we enter into the fall, we're entering into what is really a crucial time of year for most churches. The fall, for whatever reason, I guess we don't really get off of the school schedule, the fall tends to be a time of renewed focus and commitment for a lot of people. You come back from vacations, you come back from what I used to think was the relaxation of the summer, but now I realize it's the madness of the summer. I don't understand how that works, how it switches. I don't know if it's always been that way and it's just a different perspective as an adult, or if life is just crazier now. I don't know, but the summer is a little nuts for me. And so you get back into the fall and you get back into a routine, you get back into all the things that the fall brings for us, and our hope and our prayer is that this fall is a time where we can see God work in some powerful ways, and we can see some things happen around us. And this is where we have started. Last week we looked at this idea of what it means to be the church and why the church exists at all. We asked the question, why did you get up and come to church this morning? Why did you come here at all? What was the point? What got you out of bed and got you here? And we saw that there were a lot of answers for that, but really the only biblical answer for that is to glorify God, to bring Him glory. It all comes back to Jesus Christ, and that the church is built on Him and it is about Him, beginning to end. This was last week's sermon. To glorify God through Jesus Christ. That's why everything exists. To point to Him, to tell of His glory. The crazy thing is that even though that's why everything exists, the church is the chosen way, the primary way to display that glory. Not a view from a mountaintop, not looking out on an ocean, not in relationships, not in anything else except for the church, to display God's glory through the church. Now, those other things do it. I mean, if it were me, if I were making a choice on how to display God's glory, how to display my glory, if I'm God and I'm saying, I want people to know who I am, it's probably going to be tied to something that would take their breath away, a view, a strong feeling of love or emotion. It would be something that would stir people. You know, when you climb a mountain and you look out over the vista that you have there, that stirs us. I've been told when you go to the Grand Canyon, it will take your breath away. That kind of thing would be what would get me, what I would say, let's make that the pinnacle. But God doesn't say that. He says, give me the church. That's how the world will know who I am. That is an amazing thing if you stop and consider that. You are the primary way in which people will know and see God. Through the way you live, through the way you love, and through the way you share the gospel with them. That is an awesome task and responsibility. That was last week. So today we ask the question, how do we do that? What does that look like? How does the church carry that out? That mission to glorify God, that's where it starts. How do we carry that out? We're going to try to answer that this morning. We're not going to get to all of it. We'll get to more of it 2 weeks from now when we'll look at the second part of it. But you guys can go ahead and open up to the book of Nehemiah. The book of Nehemiah. We'll get there in a few minutes. It's going to be a couple minutes before we get there. But as we get started, I just want to say, I love this church. I don't feel like I say that publicly in front of everyone enough, but you need to know that I love Providence Church. And this is not the qualified I love Providence Church. You know, like, I love Providence Church for, you know, a church this size, or for a church this age, or for a church this whatever. You know what I mean? The qualified statement, the one your kids give you, like, you look good for an old person. You know what I'm talking about? When your kids kind of give you that? Or like my daughter did a few months back. We were in Townsend with my in-laws and decided we were going to go out to eat that evening. And we were going to go to a restaurant that they picked, and got to the restaurant. It was crowded. It was going to take too long. We said, well, forget it, and we'll not go there. And so we were like, okay, where do we go? And my in-laws know Townsend. Not that there's a lot to know in Townsend, but they know Townsend better than we do. And so we said, y'all pick something. And so we drove and drove, and then kind of came to the last restaurant and pulled in, and it looked shady. Like, y'all seen Hell's Kitchen? You know what I'm talking about? That kind of, or no, Kitchen Nightmares. That's the same guy. Like, you seen that thing? Like, this looked like something out of Kitchen Nightmares. And we pulled in, and Emily and I said, like, oh, this is going to be a flop. This is not going to be good. Emily's parents were in the car in front of us, and I'm like, ah, this is not going to be good. So we go in there, and we look around, and we're like, yeah, we were like, this is going to be shady. Like, do we even order? Should we, you know, save ourselves? Just pretend that we're trying to be, you know, gracious because they were going to pay for our dinner, and just pretend we're trying to be gracious and save them money when really we're just too afraid to eat, that kind of thing. But we went ahead and ordered, and we got our food, and to our surprise, it was pretty good. And we said, hey, this is really good, and Abby was kind enough to say, see, this place isn't too bad for a flop, with my in-laws sitting right there, and they thought it was pretty funny, but kind of sold us out just a little bit about our conversation in the car. Our kids are good at doing that. We've learned, you know, big ears are sitting in the back seat, so you know how that works with your kids. But this isn't that kind of qualified, you know, this is good for a flop type of thing. I love Providence Church. I mean it when I say that. I love being on this journey with every single one of you. As a pastor, I consider myself to be tremendously blessed to be able to say that. I know very few pastors, and when I say very few, I mean very few pastors who can say that. So many of them have so many struggles that just aren't here and a part of Providence, and I love you guys, and I love being a pastor here at Providence. One of the things that I love about Providence, and I think about this because of the time of year, and as school is getting started, we went to Target yesterday and bought all the school supplies and did that thing, which, by the way, let me just make a plug. We've not talked about it this year. Probably should have talked about it a little bit sooner. We will be doing Project Backpack again, but here's what we're going to ask. We've got the backpacks pretty much taken care of. We just want you guys to buy school supplies. So as you guys go out and buy school supplies over the next couple of weeks, it was 30 cents for some glue sticks yesterday. Just buy a couple of extras. Buy some pencils. Buy glue sticks. Buy that kind of stuff. We're packing the backpacks. We did it for Mount Horeb and for Jefferson Elementary. Every classroom at those two schools got a backpack last year. We're hopefully going to add a third this year to Talbot. So that'll be our third school. Our goal is to add a school every year. I hope that can happen. That's what we want to do this year. So buy some school supplies. Be bringing those in. We'll take those up the whole month of August. So just know that you're going to be hearing more about that. But one of the things that I love about our church is how many teachers we have. We have a ton of teachers here that either teach, you know, currently or are in the education system in some way, whether it's Carson Newman, the school system around here. A few of them are out trying to squeeze that last little bit out of summer, you know, just right here at the end, which it's still July. That still doesn't make sense to me that that's the end of summer, but that's where it is. So, you know, for us right now, Abby's going into third grade. Isaiah's going into kindergarten. He's getting the rest of his life started, which is even crazier to think about. I just, like, feel sorry for him. He just doesn't realize how good he's had it, I don't think. But he's going to school, and I think he's going to have fun. He's looking forward to it. So it's got me thinking about, and some of the things that we're going to talk about this morning, it's got me thinking about the teachers that I've had in school in the past, and some of my favorite teachers, and some of my bad teachers. I guess we've all got our favorites, like the ones that we can think of that we loved, and the ones that we can think of that we didn't love so much. Maybe you've got some of those yourself, but I've had some extremes kind of in both camps. I've got two that kind of hold the top spot for teacher for me. One of them was my eighth grade teacher that I started with. My homeroom teacher in eighth grade, his name was Coach Carter. He was awesome. I don't know if you guys have had that coach, not just the coach that was like the driver's ed teacher that read the newspaper while you were in class, not that guy, but the coach that was just a lot of fun, and he was a big smart aleck, and he could give back and forth with the students, and for whatever reason, he could get away with things that nobody else could get away with. You know who I'm talking about, that kind of teacher? That's who this guy was. He was awesome. He was funny. He was sarcastic. He knew just how to do it. He was a basketball coach, and he would hang out during the off season just to kind of work out with some of the middle school kids, even though he coached high school, just because he loved the middle schoolers, and he genuinely cared about kids. I saw students that were perpetual failures, and I mean that like not in a negative way, just reality. That's what they were. They somehow made it to the next grade, but they probably shouldn't have. Begin to excel in his class and achieve, that would make decent grades, because he would sit down with them and he would work with them and he would challenge them in ways that they could relate to, and he was great. But the trademark for Coach Carter was how he punished kids, right? So he didn't write kids up, he didn't send kids to the principal office, he didn't really yell at them that much. He did every now and then, but not much. He really just practiced public humiliation. That was how he liked to punish kids, right? But really the way that he would do it would specifically be in the form of a physical punishment, but not like you would think. Instead, what he would do is, like, if you were talking, you got 25 push-ups. If you were disrupting class, you may have to do like 50 air squats. You may have to do wall sits, something like that. And it was something that he would do to kind of call them out, put people in their place, and it worked for whatever reason. You would think that the kids would, you know, manipulate this, but they didn't. They liked him and they respected him. And this is what made my eighth grade year kind of rough, because I had Coach Carter for the first 8 weeks of class. And then he got transferred to Bearden High School. And we had the guy that came in behind him, and he was kind of the anti-Coach Carter, okay? His name was Mr. Schulman. He was a Vanderbilt grad, and this is not to say anything bad about Vanderbilt grads, but he was really proud of it. And he was probably the dorkiest person I've ever met. All right, he was also, we went from ultimate cool guy to the biggest just goober ever. And so, like, anytime he got confronted by a student, he would get super red-faced. Not like kind of a blush, but kind of a, like, is there something wrong with you type of deal. Like, that's what would happen to him. He'd get very, very red-faced, and he clearly had no idea how to talk to a class and how to talk to control a classroom. He was kind of effeminate in the way that he talked. It was the exact opposite of Coach Carter. And we knew that he was in trouble on the first day whenever one of those guys that had begun to excel in that class, when he had he decided he was going to kind of test the limits and see how this new guy was going to be. And so he was on the other side of the classroom, and he said, "Hey, Mr. Schulman, will you throw this piece of paper away from me?" Just random thing. And Mr. Schulman says, "Well, I guess." And so he wads up the piece of paper and he throws it at him, and he tries to catch it, fumbles it, almost falls down in his seat, as awkward and unathletic as you can possibly imagine, and then proceeded to write the student up and send that to the office. We were all like, what in the world? Like, we all knew right there in that moment that this guy was done. And he was done. He proceeded to write up. Now remember, this is Coach Carter, who never wrote up. Do y'all write up students here? Do y'all do that kind of thing? It was pink slips, that's what we called it. And so he proceeded to write up over 300 pink slips that year. It was just a joke. It was like, one guy was like, "How many can I get in one day?" And he just went banana. Like, so that was this teacher. That was my eighth grade year, both extremes. Teacher I loved, teacher I hated, that was who we got. But my favorite teacher, just the absolute best teacher that I got, and I promise I'm going somewhere with these stories, okay? Just hang with me. Was Mrs. Clark. Senora Clark, my Spanish teacher, taught Emily and I both. We loved Mrs. Clark. She was awesome. She was a teacher that truly loved her job, and she truly loved her students. She could teach, she loved to teach, but she wasn't afraid to put class on hold in order to encourage or in order to challenge. She would do things, and sometimes we might take advantage of that. Like, there was one day I had a girl that was sitting next to me, and she said, "I really don't feel like doing Spanish today. Watch this." And then she raises her hand right as class is getting ready to get started and said, "Miss Clark, can you help me out just real quick before we get class started?" And this is right as the bell was getting ready to ring. She said, "I really am struggling with this FAFSA form. Like, can you help me? How does this work?" That was all it took. For the next hour and a half, Miss Clark would go on about the importance of going to college and the importance of filling out your FAFSA, and became a guidance counselor for the next hour and a half. And she knew what the student was doing. She knew that she was being taken advantage of a little bit. And she stopped about halfway through class and she said, "Listen, I know what you're doing. I know why you did it. Sometimes you just need a break, and I understand that. And you guys need to hear this anyway. And I love you guys, so let me walk you through this." That's the kind of teacher she was. She was awesome. I remember she had us do two exercises as part of her Spanish class. Didn't do these in Spanish, just part of her class. And she had us write down where we saw ourselves in 5 years and where we saw ourselves in 10 years. Like, what our 5-year plan was, what our 10-year plan was. You're talking sophomores and juniors in high school. And so we wrote those things down. And she had us bring in an envelope, address it to ourselves, and then turn that envelope in, put those things in there. So your 5-year, your 10-year plan. Well, obviously, you hand those in, totally forget about it. 5 years later, I'm in college, and all of a sudden, this thing shows up in my mailbox. It's my handwriting addressed to me. I'm like, what in the world? It's like a Twilight Zone moment. Like, when did I write myself a letter? I don't remember doing this. And I'm like, maybe this is just like return to center. And I'm like, no, this is addressed to me. And so I open it up, and then I realize, oh, this is what we did with Miss Clark. And so the 5-year plan for me was remarkably pretty much spot on. I was married to my middle school sweetheart, so that had played out like I thought it would. I was in college. I was majoring in something I thought I could make money in. All of these things that would be good. The 10-year plan, completely shot. But the 5-year plan, I was pretty good on there. But the other exercise she had us do was this, and this is where I'm going with this big long story, so just hang in there. We had to write our epitaph. We had to write what we wanted to be on our headstone, on our tombstone there. We had to write that. We had to stop and think, what would you want to be on there that would make kind of be your legacy, that would be said of you about who you are and what your life was about. We would talk about these things, and she gave us time to meditate about it, and then we'd go around and we'd all talk about it and share ours, and I have absolutely no idea what I wrote down. So if you're looking for something profound from me, it's not going to happen. I have no clue what I put down. I was a junior in high school. Profound is not what marked me. So, but she said, and I still remember this, she said that she wanted hers to say, "It mattered that she lived." That's what she wanted on her epitaph, to say, "It mattered that she lived." I remember thinking at the time that I liked that, but the more I've thought about it over the years, the more it's kind of stuck with me. Perhaps this is something you can talk about over lunch today, what you would want to be on yours. But as I began to think about the church and the series, and I'm thinking about teachers and school, all this stuff kind of came together for me, and just began to think about that same kind of line about providence. Providence isn't dying. We're not going anywhere. We're growing, and we've got great plans ahead of us. But I just remember thinking, could people say that about us? This is what's been in my head for a few years now, but especially as I've thought about this in this series, this Welcome Home series. Does it matter that we live? That Providence lives? That you live? Not does it matter in the sense that it kind of makes people feel good for a little while, but I mean, does it eternally matter that we're here? It needs to matter on a lot of fronts. And so the rest of this morning, what I want us to see is that there's so many different ways we could apply that, but here at Providence, we have chosen a few ways that we are going to go, and we want to see that Providence matters in your life, in the life of this community, and in the lives of those around the world. So we're going to take a few minutes. We're going to read about another time when God's people really didn't seem to matter. and what that did to someone, what it did to Nehemiah. We're going to read, we're just going to see a couple things. We don't have time to go all the way through the book as much as I would love to. I actually thought about doing that, but we're just going to kind of go through a few different things here. And I've had the joy of walking through this book over the last year with Eric and with Larry in our discipleship group, and they have challenged me, and hopefully I've challenged them a little bit. And I've grown, and frankly, this book has become more important to me than I really had expected that it would. It's really pushed me. So here's the cliff notes, just the setting, kind of where we're at with the book of Nehemiah. God's people had been in exile. The Israel and Judah had been destroyed, and they had been really gone, and they were slowly coming back from exile. They'd been set free, they'd been given their release, and they were coming back, but when they came back, things were not as they had always been. The city of Jerusalem, their home, their capital, what established them as a people in that land was in ruins. And the city walls were down, and as long as the city walls were down, they would be the laughing stock. Really just nobodies. No importance. They just didn't matter. But Nehemiah saw that and he reacted to that. Now Nehemiah had it pretty good. Nehemiah had a cushy job in the palace. He didn't have to worry about anything. Everything was taken care of for him. He was comfortable. He was doing just fine. He had everything that you would want. He had safety, security, a good job. He was respected. He had everything that he could want for him and his family. But God had something greater for him in his that God had put in his heart. So look with me in chapter 1, verses 3 and 4. Chapter 1, verses 3 and 4. And they said to me, the remnant there in the province who had survived the exile is in great trouble and shame. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates are destroyed by fire. And as soon as I heard these words, I sat down and wept and mourned for days. And I continued fasting and praying before the God of heaven. We'll stop there. It's enough for us to see there at that moment. For Nehemiah, when he looked and he saw the city of Jerusalem and the state of God's people and that they were essentially nobodies, he knew what that meant. If Israel is seen as a nobody and they don't matter, then that means that God doesn't matter. That means that Yahweh, the covenant God who had come to them and who had set up the nation of Israel, his name didn't matter if the people of Israel didn't matter. If God's people were nothing more than nomads and peasants to the world, then God's name had very little chance of being made known. Nehemiah knew that building a wall was essential to reestablishing Jerusalem as a city. And it was essential, not just for God's people, but for God's name, that wall be built. And it caused him to stop and to weep when he considered the fact that God's name would be under ridicule and that it would not be as important as it should be. It broke his heart and it stopped him in his tracks. It shook him out of his comfort and his position, and it made him change his actions and his heart. And this is where our mission as Providence must begin as well. There are so many parallels that we could look at. I'm just going to pick out a couple here, and it's not a perfect parallel, so don't come and say, well, this is really talking about Israel. I understand that there's a difference between Israel and the church and what's being said there, but there's parallels that we can draw here that I think are so powerful for us. Our mission as a church must begin in the same place that Nehemiah's did. A desire for God's fame and glory. I know that was last week's message, but this is not like last week was just kind of a thing and then we move on to the next thing. This is what drives us. And so the question is, does God's glory and the desire for God to be glorified, does that break your heart that you don't see that in your neighborhood, in your family, in your community, in those that are around you, in your own life? It broke Nehemiah's heart. We must be consumed, both as individuals and corporately, by a desire to see God glorified, for his worship. That must grip us and drive us from beginning to end. This is where Nehemiah begins. This is how he begins his task. He goes to the king from here, and he boldly goes to the king and says, King, I need you to consider this. The king can see that there's something wrong with him. He can't hide his face. And he says, my heart is broken for my people and for the city. Will you allow me to go and be a part of rebuilding this city? The king grants his request, a request that could have, frankly, cost him his life, certainly his job. The king grants his request, sends him out to Jerusalem with the king's blessing, letter in hand, saying, I'm here to do this task. And if you turn to chapter 2, you'll see the first thing that Nehemiah did. Chapter 2, verse 16. This is whenever he shows up. He starts to inspect the wall. He starts to look at the city and really see what kind of shape it's in. And when the officials did not know where I had gone or what I was doing, and I had not yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, and the rest who were there, or who were to do the work. So he shows up, and he didn't tell anybody why he was there. He just shows up, and he's checking things out. He doesn't tell anybody. He doesn't announce himself. He just shows up, checks things out. And then I said to them, this is the group that were to do the work, you see the trouble we are in, how Jerusalem lies in ruins with his gates burned. Come, let us build the wall of Jerusalem that we may no longer suffer derision. And I told them of the hand of my God and what he had, and that he had been upon me for good. And I also of the words that the king had spoken to me. And they said, let us rise up and build. So they strengthened their hands for the good work. And let's stop right there. Nehemiah shows up and he looks at the city and he realizes he can't do this alone. He's going to need help. He can't build a wall himself. So after he assesses where things are, he goes and he begins to ask for help. This is no different than us. Our task, the task to bring God glory, to establish something here in Jefferson City that glorifies God and that reaches out to others, cannot be done alone. It is bigger than any one of us. This is a task we must all pull on together. And I don't have to tell most of you that. You're the ones serving in the nursery. You're the ones working with the students on Wednesday nights. You're the ones that are up here that are playing in the band, singing with the worship team, that are setting up here at 8 o'clock in the morning, that are doing whatever it takes to get this done. You know, most churches talk about how 20% of the people do 80% of the work and how that all works. That doesn't play out here. We're a church plant. It can't play out here. If it plays out like that, we're dead. We're toast. There's no way that can happen. But this takes everyone. Nehemiah showed up in Jerusalem, assessed the situation, and then he immediately went to ask for help. Because he knew if the people of God were going to be relevant again, if they were going to matter again, he needed everyone's help. And this is true for us. We don't have a whole lot of pew sitters here. We don't have pews, so you can't have pew sitters, right? We don't have a whole lot of chair sitters here. I know that you guys serve. And checking your box for service is great. That's wonderful. I'm glad that you do it. But honestly, we aren't big about checking boxes around here. You guys know that. We're not here to check boxes. We don't like wasted energy. Everything we do has a purpose. Your service has a purpose, and the reason that the program or the structure that you're serving in is here is because it has a purpose. We minimize programs. We don't do upward soccer, Tuesday night visitation, Wednesday night meals, Sunday night church, Sunday school. We don't do all of those things because we believe that if we're going to put in the structure, if we are going to establish something, then it matters. Most churches ask you to do everything and be a part of every program. And then you figure out, well, what can I be a part of? Because I can't do it all. We ask you to be a part of every program because we intentionally keep it as simple as we possibly can. Because we believe that if we are going to put it in our structure, then it is important to both Providence and to you to be a part of. This is where we want you to be. is in those things. We're going to talk about Front Porch Community, discipleship groups, all of that stuff here in just a couple of weeks and what that looks like and why we do that. But we aren't just interested in box checking, right? That's not what we're here to do, not for programs or for serving in those programs. This week I met with a pastor, Ben, right over here. He's a pastor in Missouri. He's been here for July on sabbatical, hanging out, getting to know East Tennessee just a little bit, and just kind of drove by, saw our sign, checked out our website, said, I can go to a church like that, and he's been coming back ever since. So I met with him this week, and he was very encouraging about what he sees in Providence, what he sees in what we're doing here. And one of the things that he talked about is how at their church, when they have their new members class, and I've heard this described in different ways, but I really like the way he describes this and what he talked about at their church is they tell people, and I want to tell you this, it fits right in with what we're talking about when we say welcome home, is that whenever you come to be a part of Providence, you are not checking into a hotel. You are coming home. When you go into a hotel, this summer we went to Myrtle Beach and we were there for a few days, and I remember there was one day we came back and I guess there were a couple of pillows left on the bed or something, but they didn't make one of the beds. And I was like, man, what is that all about? Why are you not going to make my bed? That's part of staying in a hotel, is because I get my bed made every day. And I was, you know, a little spoiled about it and like, well, that's no good. I expected somebody to come in to serve me. That's what happens when you check into a hotel. And for many people, when you are looking for a church, you're looking for a hotel, a place that's going to meet your needs, it's going to take care of you, and it's going to tuck you in, and it's going to make sure everything's good for you, and that whenever you leave, you come back and you'll be served well. Well, my hope is that you are served well here at Providence, but not because you got a maid staff taking care of you, but because you're at home. And this is your home. And I want you to think about what it means to be at home. When you're at home, you have to be, everybody has to contribute to the life of the home. What happens if somebody doesn't contribute? Things begin to fall apart. If you've just got one person that does the dishes, that vacuums, that makes the beds, that does the laundry, that does everything else, they can't do it all. Something gets left out. And the home becomes chaos. And things get dropped. And the funny thing is, if there's just one person doing that and something gets dropped, what tends to happen is the rest of the family will look and say, hey, how come you didn't get this done? And they say, because I'm doing all these other things. Right? You've had this conversation. You got kids. You've had this conversation. Like, you've got to carry your own weight here. You have to be a part of this. This is what part of what it means to be at home. You're a part of the family, and you're a part of what makes the home work. It's not any one person that can make a home work. It takes everybody working together, doing their part. The other thing about being a home, and the other part of what I think is great about this, when we look at it this way, is that your home becomes kind of your refuge, right? And there's two different types of people. Whenever if you live in a neighborhood, if you grew up out in the country, then maybe it's a little bit different for you. But if you live in a neighborhood, if you grew up in a neighborhood like I did, you have two different types of people, right? You got the people that pull in, shut the garage door, and you never see them again, right? And then you have the people that are out mowing their yard six times a week and always looking for somebody to talk to and always looking for people to be around. And you're like to the point like you'll wave and you don't really want to talk to them because you know if you talk to them, you're going to get stuck for a little while, right? You know that there's those different types of people, right? But everybody sees home a little bit differently. For us, we can't be the type of home where we pull in the garage, shut the garage door, and never talk to anybody. There's plenty of churches that do that. They come in, they do their thing, they do their devotions, and they're fine. Now, family devotions may be great, but nobody in the neighborhood knows them. That can't be us. As a church, we have to be a church that is out and is known in the community. That we're not just known as the church in the community center, but we're known as the church that loves the community. Do you see the difference in those things? If we're just the church in the community center, then people just know us by our house. But that's not a home. Providence is your home, if this is where you're at. Providence is your home. And it takes all of us to make a home work. It takes all of us to make it go. Somebody's got to do the dishes. Somebody's got to do the stuff. Somebody's got to mow the yard. Like, that's just how it works. Fortunately, we don't have it. That's one of the blessings of not having a building, by the way. We don't have a yard to mow. We don't have any of that that we have to worry about. There are blessings to not having a building, believe it or not. I know that you have to tell a setup that team that at, you know, February when it's 10 degrees outside and say, you know what, I'd mow a yard right now instead of being here doing this. But that's just part of it. There are blessings to not necessarily having a building. But we can't be the type of people that just shut the garage and then hunker down in our house. That can't be us. That's not what it means. We won't matter if that's what it means for us to be a church. You are a part of something bigger than yourself when you join a church. Nehemiah realized that. And he asked people to commit. He asked people to be a part of the good work. Look with me in chapter 6. One more thing I want you to see from Nehemiah. And we'll be back in this book a little bit next week as well. Chapter 6, verses 2 and 3. I just want to read this. I want you to hear what he says here. Chapter 6, verses 2 and 3. Sanballat and Geshem, that's two of the kind of rival kings or rulers, governors in the area. Sanballat and Geshem sent to me saying, come and let us meet together at the, whatever that is, in the plain of, oh no. That's funny. But they intended to do me harm. And I sent messengers to them. They intended to do him harm. Oh no. And I sent messengers to them saying, I am doing a great work and I cannot come down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and come down to you? I am doing a great work and I cannot come down. Throughout Nehemiah's rebuilding project, all the way through these six chapters here, what you've seen is opposition and distractions at every turn. There's a little bit of a scandal in there that he has to address. There's all kinds of things that are going on, accusations, everything that threatens to derail the project. Halfway through the project, he has to stop because the people are seeing what he's doing and they're starting to plan an attack to basically just stop the wall before it can even get built. So Nehemiah divides up the forces and says, all right, half of you build the wall. The other half of you stand there with spears ready to fight. So he has to do all these things that could derail the project and could get in the way. All these things that challenged his leadership, that challenged who he was, but he pressed on. And this line here in chapter 6, I think, is so powerful. And it's one that I have leaned on and that I do lean on whenever so many other things kind of vie for my attention. Faced with another distraction, Nehemiah looked around and he decided, you know what? God has given me a task. I will not be derailed from that task. I am doing a great work and I cannot come down. Nehemiah had learned what every one of us here must learn in our own lives and as a church as well. There will always be distractions and people that can derail your mission. You are called to glorify God. You are called to be on mission for God. There will always be people in the pathway to derail that. Always. That is the last thing. The last thing that Satan wants to see is you living out your mission you're called to. And so he will put anything and everything in your path to derail you. That can be terrible things, awful things, from sickness and suffering to TV and movies. It doesn't matter what distracts you, so long as something distracts you. If you're called to lead your family, men, and you are, you're called to lead your wife, when you make the resolve to do that, you sit down to think and to plan. If you get that far and you think, all right, this is what we're going to do and we're going to start it on this day, I promise you something will derail you. It will. Satan will use anything to distract you. And it doesn't have to look like bad things. Movies are fine. Money is fine. But if it distracts you from what God has called you to, then it's not fine. As a church, we are on mission. And we must pursue that mission. As a church, we want to be able to step back and look at what we're doing here in Jefferson City and not say, you know what, this is where I go to church, and yeah, it's pretty good. It's all right. It's fine. It's good. Kind of glad that it's here. Like, we have to be able to sit back and look at what we're doing at Providence and say, we are doing a great work, and we cannot come down. We are on mission, full speed ahead. We are pressing forward. As we talk about autonomy and all of these things, this is part of what should give us momentum and press us moving forward even faster, even stronger. But I promise you, things will seek to derail us. We have to decide what we're going to be as a church. If we as a church are going to change people's lives, we have to stay on task. If you are going to make a difference in people's lives, you must stay on mission. So when you wake up in the morning, you have to decide, will you be distracted and derailed, or will you be focused, intentional, and committed to God's work and His task that He has for you? Will you allow yourself to be distracted, or will you allow your life to matter? Will our church matter? Or will we all just be caught up in the distractions of the day? There are a few ways that we can answer that. We want to say, what does it mean to matter as a church? There's a lot of different ways that we could look at that. But for us as elders, we've sat down, we've talked about what does it look like for the church to matter? And that's why we're doing Worship Serve. Last year, we came, we said, If we disappeared as a church, would anybody in the community know it? Would they just be like, hey, the sign's gone in front of the community center? Oh, I don't really know who any of those people were anyway, so I don't even know who to ask about what happened there. And that would be it. We should be a vapor, a mist, gone. Or if we were to pull that sign up and we were to disappear from this community, would people say, What happened to that church that used to serve us and love us? What happened to that church that made a difference here? We need that church back. That's what we pray our testimony is, and that's what we are working towards. And we've done that in different ways over the last few years with Life Outreach Center, doing some things with them, and being able to partner with different organizations. We've decided that the schools are an important part of what Jefferson County is and the community that's here, so we are trying to partner with them. That's why we're going to do to the schools this Sunday, this next Sunday, to serve those schools, to make those schools better. We can say that Jefferson Elementary is better, at least it looks better, because Providence is here. We want to be able to be seen as a value. I can tell you last year when we did the open house, which I'm hoping we're going to be able to do again this year, when we did the open house, I had teacher after teacher after teacher come to me and say, this was by far the best attended open house I've ever had here. And I've been here for this many years and this many years. Parents came because the kids wanted to come. Just something that simple, tremendously grateful teachers. The backpacks that we give out, all of those things, so many thank yous that I wish you guys got to hear, because you guys are the ones that are doing it. We kind of become known by some people as, hey, you're the church that gives out the backpacks. When are you coming to our school? My answer is, hopefully, as soon as we can. We're trying. If we picked up the sign, we want to make sure that people notice. We want to be a church that matters. So next week, I'm asking you, be there. If you've got little kids, then I totally understand that that's going to be hard. That's why we're having the pool party that evening, so that we can still have a gathering. We can still be together on a Sunday. So you can come and be a part of that. But send somebody. Come be a part of it. Bring your tools. We're going to be doing mulching and trimming the hedges and all kinds of other stuff. So bring your yard tools that you've got. We're going to be inside washing windows, cleaning up the nasty cafeteria, the same kind of stuff that we did last year. So come ready to work. That's what we're going to do. We're going to start at 9 a.m., and then we're going to go until we're done. And then that night, we're going to get back together. We're going to celebrate baptism. It's going to be a great day. Be a part of that day. We're not doing sign-ups this year like we did last year, because we're all going to be in one location. But come be a part of that day. and then come celebrate that night. We're going to break bread together. We're going to eat food together. We're going to provide the barbecue. You guys provide the sides. And we're going to eat. And we're going to baptize. We're going to play some games. We're going to have fun. Come be a part of it. But we want to make sure that providence matters. And that's one way that we can do that. What we get to talk about over the next few weeks is we get to talk about other ways that it matters, like how it matters in your life. When we're going to talk about community, not the community, but the community we have with one another. And then we're going to talk about missions, and we're going to talk about so many other things. This is what it means to be a church family on mission. This is what it means to say, welcome home. Welcome home. You've got a job to do. That's part of being in a home. And I'm excited that I get to do it with each one of you. I'm excited that we get to do it together. This is what it means to be the church. This is not some sort of corporation. This is not some sort of like just big Bible study that we put some structure to. This is a family on mission. Will you pray with me? Father, this morning, as we look at Nehemiah and we see the task that was before him and how overwhelmed he must have felt, I know that I can feel that way so often. And so, Father, I pray that you will show us, that you will give us a picture and a vision of what it means to be the church and to love this community and to love beyond this community. To take the gospel there, not just to serve in some sort of, you know, casual way, but to take the gospel to the world so that you would be worshiped. That is our heart. That is our goal. We will shovel mulch so that you will be worshipped. We will cut grass so that you will be worshipped. We will go to the ends of the world so that you will be worshipped. We will lead our families so that you will be worshipped. We will humble ourselves and submit to your kingly leadership so that you will be worshipped. Break our hearts that we would weep for your worship like Nehemiah did. It's in Christ's name we pray. Amen.